Hey guys, we are back again today, and we're diving into the fascinating world of neuroscience and its role in conflict resolution and emotional intelligence, two things we're going to talk about in great detail today. We have a truly remarkable guest today, Doug Knoll, JD MA. Doug is an award-winning author, speaker, and trainer, and has penned the insightful book, Deescalate: How to Calm an Angry Person in 90 Seconds or Less, where he shares his expert techniques for conflict resolution and emotional de-escalation. He uses neuroscience to stop arguments, calm angry people, and promote emotional intelligence. And after a 22-year career as a trial lawyer, Doug became a peacemaker and mediator, helping people to solve deep-seated conflicts. He's co-founded the Prison of Peace Project, where he teaches prisoners in maximum security to be peacemakers and mediators. Doug is an adjunct professor at the Strauss Institute of Dispute Resolution at Pepperdine University. Today, we are going to learn how to solve some problems. So, anyway, here we go. Doug, I am excited to talk about this. I've really been looking forward to it for days. So, welcome.
Well, thank you, Michael. We're going to have a great conversation today.
We are going to have one. And we're going to get people to understand that this should be taught in schools as well as in real life. So, but I want people to know more about you before we just jump into the fact that you know how to de-escalate stuff really quickly. But let me just see what I've got written here. You are a maestro of jazz violin. You fly helicopters and aircraft, I believe that's right. Second degree black belt in martial arts, and you are a Tai Chi master. White water rafter, and you teach skiing. So instead of Doug, I'm just going to call you Leonardo today. so many things that you do. That is very cool.
You know, I've been very blessed. My life didn't start out so blessed. I was born with many disabilities, and in those days, nobody knew how to deal with somebody like me, who had all these problems, physical problems, very smart, very bright, but, left-handed, crippled, bad eyesight, hearing, I mean, you name it, I had the problems. And I had to learn how to teach myself how to do things. And so that's how I was able to accomplish. I've accomplished a lot. And the reason for that is because I learned how to learn at a very young age, because nobody could teach me. Nobody wanted to teach me. No one had the patience to deal with a kid who couldn't run, who couldn't catch a ball, who couldn't see. Who was left-handed. Nobody in the 50s wanted to mess with me. It was pretty frustrating.
Well, we are going to learn from you today. And I know that because I've been talking to you a little bit, you know, backstage before the show and last week. And I am so excited for people to learn about you, about this part of you. We'll have to talk about the karate and travel and skiing and all that stuff on another show. let's get everybody up to speed. We're going to talk about some terms that people may think they know about or don't know about. I specifically want to talk about what the terms pop psychology, neuroscience, and emotional intelligence. First of all, let's talk about what is pop psychology. You talk about that.
Well, pop is a shortened word of popular.
Okay.
Popular psychology. And popular psychology is psychology that psychological ideas or concepts that have been made popular by the popular press.
Okay.
And probably the first pop psychologist was Sigmund Freud. And he wrote a number of books, and his later books were the ones that became immensely popular in the lay public, people who haven't studied this stuff. And the problem is that everything that he taught was wrong. There's no science to support anything that he taught. But we hear things today about catharsis and, you know, the whole concept of listening therapy, psychoanalysis. And there is literally no science to support any of his theories of mind. Now, that doesn't take away from his genius. The guy was a genius because he was the first person to start thinking about, well, what's going on? What are these things we call emotions? And what's a neurosis and what's a psychosis and why do we have these problems? How do they develop?
Mm-hmm.
The problem was his data set were 16 upper middle class Viennese women in their 40s and 50s.
That was his data set.
That was his data set. No men,
uh-huh,
and white Austrian upper middle class women.
Gotcha.
Theory of mind that he developed from those 16 women.
Okay, and that is a big example of pop psychology. Yeah, we all know it. We all have problems with our mothers and fathers, and we have its egos, right, and super egos. And so we're going to let that go for a minute.
the reason that his ideas caught on is because they made sense. They comported with our everyday experience of human behavior. The problem is that our everyday experience of human behavior and our assumptions around what it means to be human are based on a 4,000 year old myth. And neuroscience is showing us that we are not who we think we are. The way we process information is completely different.
Okay, so talk about that term. Talk about neuroscience as opposed to pop or popular psychology. So
Freud was actually one of the earliest neuroscientists before he went into psychoanalysis. In his very early years, in the 1880s, he was actually studying and dissecting planaria. Planaria are flatworms. And the reason that planaria are studied is because their central nervous system is very simple and easy to look at with a very low powered microscope. And of course, in the 1880s, they don't have the technology they had today. From there, the only way that scientists could study how the brain functions is primarily through pathology. In other words, dissecting brains after people have died and trying to find out what was not functioning, and also mapping anatomical structures in the brain, the physical anatomical structures, and then looking at people who were injured, had brain injuries, and how did their behavior change, and what part of their brain was destroyed, or it's called brain lesion studies.
Okay.
And then scientists started studying with mice, and they would take mice and they would disrupt or cauterize different parts of the brain, and they would want to see how did the mouse's behavior change. So we had this, that was all pretty much 20th century until the 1990s, when functional magnetic resonance imaging technology was developed. And basically, fMRI studies allowed scientists for the first time to watch a human brain in operation without invasive surgery, without anything. And basically what fMRI does is it looks at blood flow. Blood has hemoglobin in it.
Yes.
Hemoglobin has a lot of iron in it. So if you put a big magnet around my head, I can see where the hemoglobin is accumulating in the brain, which is an analog to, if there's blood in that part of the brain must be active. There must be some activation going on. So we can see when we give the subject some kind of stimulus, external stimulus, we're going to see blood flow activate in the parts of the brain that are processing information more than other parts.
So, okay, so we're going to hold on to that one.
Okay.
And then the last thing I want to make sure everyone understands and we can talk about is emotional intelligence, because I don't know what people know about other intelligence, but what
they've heard about, right, intelligence. So two psychologists, Peter Mayer and John Salovey, and they actually had one other colleague whose name escapes me at the moment. In the 1980s, we're studying the idea that there's more than one kind of intelligence. Everybody knows about the Stanford-Binet test, the IQ test. So we have the intelligence quotient. That's been around for a long time. These guys were thinking that, well, intelligence is a lot more than just how well you can solve puzzles in a time limit. And so they started coming up with the idea of social intelligence. And one of the types of social intelligence they began to think about was what they called emotional intelligence.
Okay.
And they wrote a bunch of seminal papers in the late 1980s and the early 1990s. And a New York Times science journalist who happened to be a PhD in psychology, Daniel Goleman, picked up on their work.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote a book that was published in 1995, Emotional Intelligence, Why It Matters More Than IQ. And he has made a bazillion dollars on this concept of emotional intelligence. The problem with emotional intelligence is that once you move outside of academia,
mm-hmm,
people make all kinds of claims around emotional intelligence that just are unsupported by science. And so if you look at the academic literature that's been developed over the last 30 years, and mm-hmm, then you compare it to the commercial emotional intelligence training worlds. They're in, like, they're in different universes.
Gotcha.
So what I figured out was that, number one, if you talk about learning emotional intelligence, you can't learn emotional intelligence, just like you can't learn IQ, because an emotional intelligence is an assessment. It's a test.
Okay.
What you can do is you can develop emotional competency, which are certain teachable skills, learnable skills that will increase your emotional intelligence as measured by, for example, the Mayer Salobi Caruso emotional intelligence test, the MCET, which is the gold standard for measuring this stuff. And there are three basic emotional competencies that you can master. One, emotional self-awareness. What am I feeling right now? Two, emotional self-regulation. How do I behave even though I have this emotion that's telling me to do, to react? How do I behave around that? How do I can regulate my behaviors around my emotions? And number three, empathy, cognitive and affective empathy. Mm-hmm. And what I've learned through a series of discoveries and a lot of research and a lot of field work is that when you learn cognitive empathy, which is called affect labeling, you automatically develop emotional self-awareness and emotional self-regulation. So just by learning the skill of affect labeling, your whole life changes forever.
Gotcha. You know, this, I said this to you before the show, that this stuff ought to be taught in school and that we need to learn these skills as kids so that life becomes easier and better and doable.
That's right.
Yeah.
Let me just say, I just watched a colleague of mine sent me a YouTube video yesterday of a four-year-old who was demonstrating self-affect labeling. It was a 2.5-minute video. It was the most profound thing I've seen in a long time. When a four-year-old can label his emotional experience and talk about what he was feeling and why he felt it, I mean, it was unbelievable. And I said, this is how every four-year-old has to have this skill.
How did the four-year-old learn this?
Parents.
Well, okay. So he's going to grow up to be, or she or they are going to grow up to be a well-balanced person who can.
Well, I'm going to tell you more than that, because what the studies show is when you start teaching 2, 3, and 4-year-olds how to manage their emotions, they become emotionally competent. By the time they're 12 years old, all the studies show they're 2 grade levels ahead of their peers academically. They have the emotional maturity of a 21-year-old. They make better decisions. And they are well liked by all of their peers and adults around them. They're completely different human beings than their peers.
I love that. I want to jump into a juicy topic here with you, the prison project that you do and teaching prisoners maximum security. And when we think, at least when I think maximum security, I'm thinking people who have murdered other people, knives, guns, drugs.
I think Charles Manson.
Charles Manson.
I taught for 3 years, 100 feet from his cell.
Wow. Okay. How? Okay. First of all, what are the arguments that come up in a prison? And then how do you de-escalate those things? That's broad. So first of all,
one of the reasons, there are many reasons why there is prison violence. Okay. One of the foundational reasons is that when an individual goes into prison, they are stripped of all their identities. Mm-hmm. So they're given a number and a last name, and they have no identity beyond that. And when you have your identity stripped away, you become very protective of the limited identity you have. So mm-hmm. The slightest insult can explode into violence because you are protecting your identity. And of course, these people are in prison in the first place because they didn't have the skills to deal with upset and emotions on the outside. Mm-hmm. And so because of every single one of them has been deeply emotionally abused and traumatized. And so they don't have any skill sets. And so they tend to go just be reactive and go back to their childhood programming, which is lash out. And you'll see these people in prison, they're all tatted up and they're looking mean and evil and dark. They do that for a reason. They do that so that nobody messes with them. But what's really interesting is when you get to know these people, they hate violence. In fact, that's how we started the project. My colleague and co-founder and dear friend Laurel Coffer received a letter in 2009 from a woman serving a life sentence without possibility of parole to come into the largest, most violent women's prison in the world, which happened to be about an hour and a half from where I live in Central California, to train all the lifers, women lifers in the prison, about 150 of them, how to become peacemakers and mediators to stop the prison of violence. They were tired of it. So that's how the project got started.
So many questions I have. So you're walking into this environment, and you just said it's a violent environment, but also nobody really likes this environment that's in it. They don't condone violence, I guess, is what you're saying.
They will use violence as an instrumentality for power and control. Men are very different in prison than women are. It's a very different environment, different power stuff going on in a men's prison versus a women's prison.
So give me an example of, let's talk, I guess, men's prison to start with, of something that's going to turn violent, and what happens?
Well, in men's prisons, all prisons are divided into yards. Most prisons in California have yards. So you'll have a yard, B yard, C yard, and a D yard, for example. And each yard, a typical California prison, will be between 800 and 1,200 people living on that yard.
Wow.
Some yards are run by gangs. And so you'll have the gang will be in the yard, and the gang leaders will control the yard. They control everything.
Okay.
And you can't do anything violent unless you get permission from the yard boss. And so if people step out of line, they get brutalized as a message to everybody, toe the line and obey. So the men's prisons on some of these higher level security yards are organized to stop violence. So it's a controlled violence. And if you step out of line, or you're in the wrong gang, or you do the wrong thing, you're going to get a knife, or you're going to get beat up, you know, or you're going to get raped, all kinds of horrible things. Those are typically in California, the level 3 general population yards. There are other yards where that does not exist, and you have a general population, and people in those yards oftentimes are trying to program themselves to get out of prisons. They're going to school, they're getting their education, they're doing vocational training, you know, they do whatever they can to help themselves. So that's a different kind of yard. Those are the yards that we worked in. We didn't work in gang yards. The gangs didn't want us.
Right.
We would take power away from them by teaching people how to de-escalate. We worked in level 4, the highest level, supermax prisons. I worked in Corcoran State Prison, where Charles Manson was housed for 3 or 4 years before the pandemic. And level 4, I was working with, in that prison, I was working with men who were coming out of gangs. They were in a gang deprogramming program. First time I met them, I was in this dungeon, and I had a circle of 20 cages around me in a half circle. And the men were in leg and arm shackles inside cages. And those were my students.
Okay, so they're in cages, in shackles, and you're in the middle teaching them to de-escalate violence, and they're living literally in physical violence
That's right.
So how do you start that and that process? First of all, you have to get them
First of all, people, we announce, we have a process. We announce that Prison of Peace is going to be starting in the yard. And we have an orientation session. We didn't do it at Corcoran. I'm not sure how we got started in Corcoran, but in a typical yard, we would go into a gymnasium, and there would be an invitation, and we'd get maybe 100 men or women would come in, and for an hour, and we would give them the orientation, and we would tell them what Prison of Peace is. It's a very rigorous training program to teach them how to become effective mediators and peacemakers to stop violence. And we do everything we can in that orientation to dissuade them from joining the program.
Why?
Because it's rigorous. And we know there's going to be, if we don't, we only want the people who are really attracted to it. They really feel it in their heart, that they feel it as a calling. We don't want the people who are just coming in because they want to get off the yard and come into an air conditioned space and basically goof off. We don't want those people. We want the people. There is a certain percentage of people on every yard that we have gone into who have felt drawn. They don't know why they feel drawn to the program, but something about it resonates with them.
Okay.
Those are the people we want. And we try, in every prison, we'd start off with 25. Our very first cohort would be 25 people. And then Laurel and I spent months as professors and trainers, and we've been doing mediation training, and, you know, we're both of us are extremely well known in our profession internationally. And we took all of our combined knowledge and experience and devised a curriculum with the assumption that not one of our students had any social skills that would be useful in mediation. If you just do a regular community-based mediation program, people come in and they got some skills, right? And right. All we're doing is teaching them, adding on, leveling up, but they have some basic skill sets. In prison, no, zero skill sets. So to answer your question, the very first thing we teach them as a skill is how to listen. We call it reflective listening, and we teach them the four levels of reflective listening: okay. Mirroring, paraphrasing, core messaging, and affect labeling. And that's the foundation of our entire program.
Does your student population, the people you're teaching, do they include in the level of prison that you're in, the yard bosses and?
No, we don't, because we didn't work. We were not welcome in yards that were being run by gangs.
Okay, so the populations you're working with are people who basically can get along and there's not a hierarchical leadership.
Well, there is, tends to be a hierarchical leadership, but it's not enforced with violence like in a gang yard.
Okay.
There are always leaders in every yard, and typically the leaders were the ones that we started working with first. They saw the power of what we were doing, and so we would get the leaders.
That's what I was asking. So you get.
And then ultimately, those leaders became trainers. It took 3 years to take somebody who was just didn't know anything, and get them to a level where they could actually start teaching other people how to do it.
Are the people that you're training life with no possibility of parole, or just
life and long-term sentences? Okay. So you can have a life sentence and still get parole.
Correct.
25 to life, for example. We wanted to work with the long-term populations because we were going to invest 3 years in a prison, and we wanted people there to be there for a while to teach other general population incarcerated people how to become peacemakers and mediators. So we wanted to cadre people that were probably not going to get out for a while.
Okay, give me an example of somebody who's now been trained up. There's steps since it's three-year program, but somebody who's actually been trained up and there's a violent situation happening or getting ready to happen, and how that was mediated by somebody that you trained.
I'll tell you one of the early stories. Okay. We were in the women's prison, Valley State Prison for Women. And we came in to do, on one of our Wednesdays, come in and train our people. And the women told us this story. She changed her name. Her name was Shelby Harris, black woman, very powerful, charismatic woman. And we heard the story of the week before, the women gangs, they were lining up on the yard to go into a melee. And all the correctional officers were running out with all their riot gear. Shelby walks out. She grabs one leader and another leader by the neck, walks him over to the fence, slams him against the fence, mediates the dispute right there, and that's the riot never started.
Wow. Okay. So she was strong enough to just say, come with me. We're talking.
Yep.
Okay.
We're going to talk.
All right.
That was kind of an amazing story, but that's the level of competency that we train to.
Okay. I want to... since most of our audience is not going to be in prison right now, I want to talk about stuff. Yeah. I want to talk about real world situations.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I don't usually talk about politics on this show, and we're not going to talk politics today, but I do want to talk about sides. And we know that our country is fractured right now, especially with politics, you've got the Republican side, you've got the Democrats, and there's other people, but those are the two main sides right now. How would you take someone who is adamantly pro-Trump and someone who's adamantly pro-Biden/Democrat and get them to even listen to each other, because both of them know that they're right and both of them know that the other person's wrong?
All right. Great question. Having a calm conversation with the politically polarized is a four-step process.
Okay.
And before you even have a conversation, you've got to go into the conversation with a desire not to persuade, not to change somebody's perspective, not to prove that you're right and they're wrong, not to prove that they're complete idiots and they don't know what they're talking about. All right. So your mindset has to be, I'm going into this conversation to listen and learn. I'm not going in to persuade or argue or fight.
That's a tough, tall order right there.
Well, but that's the mindset. And then once you have that mindset, you sit down with Uncle Charlie, mm-hmm. who's rabidly crazy, in your opinion. And the first thing you ask Uncle Charlie is, so Uncle Charlie, what are all the life experiences that you've had that lead you to the values and beliefs you have today around politics?
Okay.
And he's going to start telling his story about why he believes the way that he believes. And basically, all you do is listen and reflect, an affect label, mm-hmm. emotional reflection. The second question then is, so Uncle Charlie, how do your values and beliefs help you in your day-to-day decision-making and how you navigate through life?
Okay.
Again, Charlie tells stories and you affect label. Third question, Uncle Charlie, what do you do with, how are you around people who disagree with you, who have radically different values and beliefs? And, you know, the first snarky comment is, well, of course, I take my rifle out and I shoot them. Mm-hmm. That's almost always the response from the right. And so you just laugh and you say, no, really, how do you deal with that? And you reflect what they say because you're mm-hmm. really listening. And then the last question is, so Uncle Charlie, you know, we live in this big country, pluralistic society. How should we manage ourselves to deal with all of these different beliefs and values mm-hmm. from yours to somebody who is radically different than you? How should our society be structured to manage all of that? And of course, they've never thought about that question before.
Right.
So now you get them into a discussion. And what you learn as you listen to the answers to these four questions is that you have far more in common with Uncle Charlie than you have in difference. And then what you learn, you both learn that politicians are exploiting us for money and for votes. They're trying to protect their own power, position, and privilege mm-hmm. to the detriment of the country.
Let me back up for 1 second. When you go into this discussion, is it left asking right and then right asking left the questions, or is there a mediator asking?
No, you can do it yourself, and it doesn't matter whether you're on the right asking somebody who's on the left, or you're on the left and you're asking somebody on the right, or you are in the middle. Mm-hmm. Now, you could have somebody like me, a mediator, come in and facilitate this kind of conversation. And the way that I would do that is I'd set up a circle process where everybody's sitting in a circle. And I'd go around the circle, set the ground rules, and then go around the circle and I'd ask each person to respond to these four questions.
Okay.
And in our listening circles, the way, and this is what we teach in prison, is that the first person speaks, they have a talking stick, we have a centerpiece. First person speaks, the next person on the left, who's going to be the next speaker, has to earn the right to speak. And that is done by reflecting what the first speaker said, meant, and felt.
Gotcha.
Then once they have a dialogue, and once the initial speaker says, yes, I feel heard, talking mm-hmm. stick gets passed to the left. Now we have a new speaker. And that speaker then would just now talk about, well, what are all the things in my life that led me to the values and beliefs that I have today? Mm-hmm. They would talk on that. When they're finished, the person to their left now has to reflect to them until they feel reflect, you know, their words, their meaning, and their feelings, emotions.
What if the person on the left doesn't get it right?
Then they go back and they negotiate. So if they don't get it right, then the person tells what was wrong, restates the story, and now the listener reflects again. And right. This might be a dialogue that takes two or three iterations before.
Now, the person on the left, do they, if they don't agree or they don't understand?
It has nothing to do about agreement.
You just need to say, this
you
is
need
what
to reflect
said.
What the other person said, felt, said, meant, and felt.
Okay.
It doesn't matter whether you agree with it or not.
Right. You just need to know that I heard what you said. This
yeah,
is it.
We don't use I statements. Oh. You said. You said, you meant, you felt.
Okay.
You statements only. This whole I statement stuff, that's more pop psychology. Totally wrong. Doesn't work. Never has worked. Never will work. Do not use I statements when you're reflecting somebody else.
Right. You said this, you did that, you feel this way.
Correct.
Gotcha. That makes a lot of sense. So right. You get around the whole circle, everyone should kind of understand, at least the person to the right, what that person
said. And then you ask the next question. All right, so how do your values and beliefs that you just talked about, how do they help serve you in your everyday life? You go around the circle and everybody speaks to that. So it doesn't matter who's in the circle. Everybody's speaking to their own experience. Nobody's challenging. Nobody's saying you're wrong. Nobody's saying that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. Everybody's talking from their personal experience, which cannot be challenged because you own what you own.
Yeah.
And then they're deeply listened to.
By the way, when you started doing this in the prisons and you had the guys in cells and cuffs, did it ever get to a point where you were not in cells and cuffs, but we're all just sitting in the
circle? Oh, yeah. Yeah. Even in the Corcoran, we eventually had them in a classroom where we would do peace circles or teach them how to mediate or teach them all the skills we teach them. And they were just, you know, they were there. Mm-hmm. And that happened pretty quickly.
So how do you get, I'll go into another one that's more historical, more personal. You've got, in our country, we had slavery.
Right.
We have the KKK. We've got other, nationalist groups or what's it, you know,
right. White nationalism, white heads, whatever. Christianity, really.
Okay.
Pretty
intense. How do you get the guys in the hood to listen to the white nationalist? And what I that one I'm going to have trouble with. Maybe.
No, this, believe me, prisons are microcosms of our society.
Yeah.
You know, we have white nationalists, we have black people, Asians, Latina people. I mean, all different ethnicities, Pacific Islanders, you name it, you got it. And these are people at the bottom of our society coming from all different ethnicities, beliefs, educational levels, languages, and they're all crammed in together in this very unnatural environment.
So,
the trick to peace is teaching them how to listen and reflect.
Okay. At what point do you say, I've heard you, I feel you, I understand your pain? Well, you said this, and I understand what you're saying. Okay, we've gotten to a common vocabulary. How does that become peaceful if they still don't agree?
Well, so you can, first of all right, so we teach them in the first module, the peacemaking circle keeper module, we teach them how to listen, and then we teach them how to be a circle keeper. And I just described the circle keeping process. Mm-hmm. So that's the first thing they learn. And what they learn as they are circle keepers is that people can have very diverse perspectives, and yet you may disagree with it, but you can still respect people for who they are.
Yes.
And you have a deeper conversation than you would ever have otherwise. And you learn who this person is as a human being. And so you can respect the human being, even though you might not agree with their values and beliefs. Their values and beliefs are just one part of who they are, but not all of who they are. And so we move away from stereotyping, which is one of the three ways of moral disengagement.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I listen to sometimes these Senate hearings, you know, where you bring in the experts and they're talking and answering questions for the senators. But I don't ever feel like the senators are listening. They're just coming up with their sound bites for the media.
That's right.
And don't give a crap about what is actually being said.
That's right.
So in that environment, I don't see how anything actually ever gets done.
It doesn't.
Okay. Just wanted to make sure.
No, it doesn't.
Okay. So how would we fix those debates, discussions in the Senate so that...
We can't. They don't want to learn.
Okay.
They're not interested in that. The House of Representatives, not interested in listening.
Okay.
They're get this. Politicians are only interested in one thing, protecting their power, position, and privilege. They are not interested in anything else. So whatever protects their power, position, and privilege, that's what they're going to do to get them reelected in their congressional district.
Yeah.
And if you got a congressional district that is MAGA, then the most MAGA person that can run for office is going to get elected, until somebody who's even more MAGA is going to get elected.
Right.
Once they get into Congress, they're already dysfunctional human beings because they can't listen. They can only listen to the people that they're like. They haven't learned how to negotiate. They haven't learned how to compromise. They haven't learned how to solve problems. They've only learned how to espouse a particular perspective. So now they're coming into a collegial body where compromise, negotiation, listening, solving problems is the purpose of the institution.
Yeah.
And they don't have any skill sets that allow them to do that. So what do? They revert back to what got them elected, which was, you know, whatever extreme view they want to take on.
Yeah.
To play to the media, which then is seen and heard by their constituents in their districts.
So how do all of us, you know, however many hundreds of millions of people there are in the US right now, mm-hmm. are being basically, I'll say the broad word, being controlled by a very small, not even percentage, it's like a 0% of the population.
The way I look at it is I don't care what political party you're in. Uh-huh. If you lead me to the light, I'll vote for you. If you lead me to the dark, forget it. So I look for people who are going to lead me to the light. And I'm an independent. I'm not a registered Democrat or a registered Republican.
Yeah.
There are like Liz Cheney. Now, she has a lot of conservative views that I don't particularly agree with, but she is the leader of the light.
Mm-hmm.
I would follow Liz Cheney.
Yeah.
Joe Biden leads us to the light. He's always looking for the good. And you can argue about his politics and his policies, but there's a guy who's not trying to destroy. He's trying to create. He's trying to lead us to the light. I can follow him.
Mm-hmm.
The politics of Liz Cheney and Joe Biden probably couldn't be any more different.
Right.
But they're both high integrity people that are trying to lead to the light. That's how I discern who to vote for. And so when we come around to election season, it happens that I live in the congressional, Kevin McCarthy's the Speaker of the House. I live in his congressional district. He's my congressman, as it turns out. I can't vote for Kevin McCarthy. He does not lead to the light.
Okay.
He leads to the dark. So, or he caters to the dark in order to maintain his position as Speaker of the House. No integrity. I will not countenance that.
You know, let me ask you a what if question. In a minute, we're going to play a game of this or that. Mm-hmm. But Elon Musk wants us to, you know, a lot of people want us to spread out in the solar system and go to new planets, moon, whatever. If you were setting up Mars, let's say all the infrastructure is ready to go, you can breathe in domes or whatever you have to do. What kind of like a society would you set up so that we don't have some of the problems that we experience here on our current Earth? How would you manage it? What would it look like?
Well, we're never going to avoid the problems of human beings living with each other.
Okay.
What we can do is learn the skill sets that allow us to deal with the inevitable conflicts that arise, the fights and arguments that arise, in a way so that those fights and arguments essentially go away.
Mm-hmm.
And so the first thing that I would be doing is teaching people how to listen to each other, and then the next step is listening to each other and then engaging in the continuum of problem solving skills that exist so that we know how to work with the kinds of frictions that come up when human beings are living with each other. And the other thing we do is set up expectations. For example, in a democracy, there is going to be conflict.
Mm-hmm.
There are going to be opposing views. But in a strong democracy, you have the opportunity to speak. You have the opportunity to be heard. That's called procedural due process in the law. And you have the ability to make your argument, hopefully be listened to. But maybe your ideas are not going to be accepted by the majority. And the minority has to learn to accept the decision of the majority as long as the majority's decision is not oppressive or violate certain fundamental rights. And so the expectation in any environment is that if we're going to have a democratic system where the majority basically is going to call the shots and we have checks and balances for protecting the rights of the minority so they're not oppressed. But if you're not being oppressed and you simply disagree with the decision, you agree that you're going to support the decision. That's the expectation. And if you don't have that expectation, you don't belong in this community.
Gotcha. Let me ask you, we started out with this, and I mentioned that it would be great if we actually taught this in schools. Like, How would one get this into schools? In other words, do we have to start with the parents at home, or do we have to start with teaching teachers, or do we have after-school programs to teach kids how to do these negotiation life skills? How would you do that if we want
all,
to change
all of the above plus, all of the above plus more?
Okay.
So let's just go through some of the things we can do. I have worked in schools.
Okay.
I've trained teachers and administrators how to listen. We've gotten phenomenal results. It's very difficult to break into school districts and school systems because they're extremely bureaucratic and they are under enormous pressure from all different directions. So when you show them this phenomenally powerful skill, mm-hmm. because they are so distracted, it's very difficult to get their attention on something that can change everything. So one, we can start training teachers and administrators and school boards how to listen. The four levels of reflective listening. That would be a huge. I have taught teachers. I'm working with a teacher right now who is he's a science teacher, middle school science teacher in Kentucky. Mm-hmm. And what he's learned from me completely changes everything in the classroom control. He says it's changed my life. And now he's starting to teach other teachers how to do this.
That's awesome.
So that's one level. Another level that I think would be really, this would be beyond cool, is in pre-K schools, pre-kindergarten, daycares, mm-hmm. and starting at about 2 years old in child care centers. Good pre-K, pre-kindergarten, a child before kindergarten, they have to learn, master over 300 different skills. Most people don't know this.
I did not know that.
Yeah, they have to master 300. If they're going to succeed in school, they have to master 300 basic human skills before they can be successful in kindergarten. Pre-K programs should be, if they're good programs, they're helping these children, these toddlers, start mastering these skills. For example, putting a square peg into a square hole. Mm-hmm. That takes eye-to-hand coordination. It takes spatial processing development. It takes problem-solving skills, it develops patience, and it teaches trial and error, scientific method, just by not putting the ball in the square hole, but putting the peg in. Think about everything that has to happen in order for that simple little skill set to
right.
be
developed.
All right, multiply that by hundreds, and you can see what you need to learn. Well, one of the things that we can teach little children is how to listen to emotions.
Nice.
And so we should be engaged in training emotional competency from the time children start to verbalize at about 18 months. Parents won't be able to do it because they weren't taught how to do it.
Right.
Now, that doesn't mean they can't learn, but most parents are going to parent the way they were parented. So correct. We have a cycle that goes on for generations. However, if you put a 2 or 3 year old into a pre-K program where you got qualified teachers to start teaching children how to listen to emotions in a structured way, in the way that we teach it, that would be a profound shift. In 20 years, we'd be living in a different world.
Yes, we wouldn't. We wouldn't be so afraid of the AI that's going to kill us because we already taught it from what we know.
And crime would be dramatically reduced. And prisons would be greatly reduced. Just all kinds of things, positive things flow from this idea.
I would love to see this happen in life in general. I think it would be amazing absolutely. If people learned to listen.
I mean, study, this is all grounded on science. The scientific studies around this cannot be challenged. It's hard yeah. science. It shows how does the human brain develop? It develops emotionally. It doesn't evolve intellectually. And yet our whole educational system is based on training what's known as the task-focused system in the brain.
Right.
When what we should be focusing on is training what's known as the default mode or social system in the brain. That's where we should be focusing our training. It's completely ignored in education.
I 100% agree with you. And you didn't even have to like shift me to the patient, to the to the new way of thinking. I love what you're saying, and I love the way that you actually have a system for getting it out there. I want to let's do a little fun thing. I've learned a lot here. I want to learn more about Doug Knoll. We're going to ask you some questions. This or that, you can answer one or the other, but not neither or both. Okay. If you have to explain yourself on any of them, you can. So it's just fun. Choose one or the other. There's you can, however you interpret the words is the right answer for you. Okay. Mm-hmm. We'll start super easy. Neuroscience or psychology?
Neuroscience.
There you go. Mediation or confrontation?
Super mediation.
Easy. Okay. Logic or emotions?
Emotion.
Speaking or listening?
Listening.
Teaching or learning?
Learning.
Okay. Let's get a little more difficult. About reading people's emotions or reading people's minds?
Reading emotions.
Okay. Calm a room of angry people or calm one very angry person?
Say that again. What was the
calming problem? A room of angry people or calm one very angry person?
See, so contextual, it's really hard to answer.
Right. It's meant to be.
I would calm the room.
Okay. You answered this earlier, but I want to make sure. Emotional intelligence, born or made?
Emotional intelligence or what now?
Born or is it made?
It's made.
Okay. Trust your brain or trust your gut?
Don't trust either.
Okay. What would you do instead? Learn the technique and...
Learn how, when you're talking about brain or gut, you're really talking about what kind of decision-making process are you involved in. So when you're trusting your gut, you're really talking about intuition. Intuition is a powerful way to make decisions, but only in a very narrow scope of decision-making.
Okay.
Too many people want to trust their gut because they're lazy. They're lazy thinkers. They've got a lazy system to processing. Mm-hmm. So it's just easier to trust your gut because I don't have to think about it. But they end up with disastrous decisions in high risk situation. Okay. Can't trust your brain because we have all these cognitive biases.
Yeah.
That there are 150 cognitive biases that distort our decision making.
Right.
So you have to learn about all this stuff and then learn processes for making good decisions.
Okay. Let's do this one. How about diffuse an argument or avoid it altogether?
Diffuse.
Okay. Let's get a little more difficult. How about talk to someone who agrees with everything you say or someone who disagrees?
Listen to somebody who disagrees.
There you go. Emotionally intelligent leader with less experience or experienced leader with low emotional intelligence?
Take the person with the high emotional intelligence every single time.
Okay, I like that. Live in a world without conflict or a world where conflicts are solved quickly?
We don't want to live in a world where there's no conflict. We want to live in a world where there is conflict, but conflict is used as a tool for growth.
Okay. How about win an argument but hurt the relationship or lose an argument but preserve the relationship?
How about not arguing at all and preserve the relationship?
Okay. That's what we're going to start teaching these pre-Ks.
That's right.
Be emotionally competent but not as happy or blissfully ignorant but happy?
I will take emotional competency because in my experience, once you're emotionally competent, you're going to be much happier than being ignorant.
Okay. Let's do some thought provoking. Would you rather live in a world where everyone understands and controls their emotions perfectly, but has less empathy, or a world where everyone is highly empathetic, but emotions run high and unchecked?
Well, the problem with those two statements is that we're not defining empathy.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead and define it.
So empathy is the ability to read, assimilate, interpret,
okay,
understand, and reflect back the emotional experience of another person. So I would prefer to live in a world where people have empathy, high levels of empathy, because then people are understanding each other at a very basic level. They understand you're having an emotional experience.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to living in a world where there's no empathy and emotions are running amok, which is just chaos.
Yeah. By the way, what's your take on people being afraid of AI these days? I don't know if you're studying it or listening.
Yeah, I looked at it. I think a lot of this is coming from science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when you look at ChatGPT, for example, like it can do some pretty amazing things, but it's not going to take over the world.
No.
I think it raises the type of generative AI that we're seeing now is has some interesting moral issues around it. Mm-hmm. But it's just another tool. Remember when automobiles were invented? Michael, remember this. Back in the 1890s, people said if you went faster than 25 miles an hour, your brain would explode. Because the only reference point they had was in a fast carriage being drawn by horses. That's all they knew.
Okay.
And so everybody thought that these newfangled internal combustion things were going to kill off humanity because we could not withstand the acceleration beyond 25 miles an hour, because that's the fastest anybody had ever gone in the history of humanity. And of course, it was totally wrong because it was a biased belief based on insufficient data.
I think I totally jive with that analogy, and I think that our AI is the same way right now. Mm-hmm. We're not even close to science fiction levels of AI,
right?
And people are worried about things that might or might not happen, but we're going to grow with them anyway.
Well, and also remember that we're reading about all this fear-mongering in the media, and why are editors and journalists fear-mongering?
So we can sell more things, and so we can stay in control.
Actually, more eyeballs on the page.
Yeah.
We want more clicks for the advertisers.
Yeah.
So we get fed. One of the great benefits of the internet, and I mean, I grew up in a non-internet world, as you did, but one of the great benefits of the internet is we have vast amounts of information that are available to us at any moment. All of human knowledge is essentially available to us. The problem is that information is not curated for us. We have to be our own curators of knowledge and information. Back in the 50s and 60s, when we grew up, we were watching Walter Cronkite, right? Yep. And Uncle Walter was the curator of the world news for us.
Yep.
Evening news with Walter Cronkite. We would watch ABC or NBC or CBS on a little black and white television screener, and then the 60s turned to color television. And all the information that we received from the newspapers to television was curated by editors and producers and presenters, so that we only saw the stuff that was they wanted us to see. Mm-hmm. And we didn't have to worry about curating news, because it was curated for us, whether it's New York Times, the LA Times, Chicago Sun, Tribune, all these different newspapers, same thing. News was curated. Books, you know, the only way you got a book published was by going through a big publishing house. They curated authors so that the information presented to us, I mean, it certainly was biased in many ways, but the point being that today none of this is curated.
That people don't stop and think, because they don't know how to anymore.
That's right. These are not the skills. The skills that we learned as children in the 50s and 60s are not the skills that children need to have today.
Yeah.
They need a completely different set of skills in order to deal with the information overwhelm. And they're not being taught those skills. We're still using a 19th century educational pedagogy in the 21st century.
Gotcha. Let me ask you two more of this or that questions, a little bit deeper, but I think the first one's easy. The second one may be a little bit, not tough, but more thought-provoking. So if emotional intelligence could be taught in school as a mandatory subject, would you replace it, would prefer to replace a traditional subject like math or science, or should it be an additional subject, and how do you justify that?
Well, that's an interesting question, because the whole core curriculum that was developed starting in 2007, 2008 has a core component called socio-emotional learning. Mm-hmm. And what the educators who put this together at a national level, brilliant people, recognized that socio-emotional learning is pervasive throughout all topics, whether it's mathematics or geometry or literature or language studies. Yeah. Everything is imbued with emotion. And so 60% of the core curriculum, when properly implemented, is teaching students how to be emotionally competent. At the same time, they're learning the core STEM skills, for example, science, mm-hmm. technology, engineering, and math. Though all of those subjects have a lot of emotionality to them. Most people think it's very Spockian, right? No. Science, mm-hmm. technology, engineering, math, every aspect of those subjects is emotional. If you're not emotionally competent, then you're going to make a lot of mistakes in the STEM subjects.
So
So I would go back and say, let's just, I know there are a lot of people that don't understand the core curriculum principles. They think it's some woke leftist craziness. It's not. It's based on science. And so I'm saying we can have both and.
Okay.
Because that's what the core curriculum is all about.
Nice. Let me ask you one more question. If you could enhance one aspect of every human's emotional intelligence for the betterment of humanity, would you choose empathy, self-awareness, self-regulation, motivation, or social skills, or something different?
Empathy. Once you learn cognitive empathy, the way I have defined it,
mm-hmm.
once you learn the skill of cognitive empathy, which doesn't take that long to master, in my coaching and my students, my clients that come in, I can typically have them at a pretty high level of cognitive empathy in 8 to 10 weeks of training. That's for adult learners.
Mm-hmm.
And then everything else that you mentioned flows from that.
Awesome. Doug, this has been a fascinating conversation. I love the fact that you are the Da Vinci of our times. I want people to be able to stay in touch with you or get in touch with you. We've got your DougKnoll.com website where they can find you.
They can find me there. My email address is Doug@DougKnoll.com. That's pretty straightforward.
That's easy.
You can find me. I'm mostly active on LinkedIn, not as active, although I have fairly large followings on other social media platforms. I spend most of my time on LinkedIn because that's where my clients are
mostly. Absolutely.
And send me an email, if you'd like a chat, I can send you a calendar link. I'm happy to chat with people about my work. And my thing is, if you have fights and arguments in your life, whether they're in your business and professional life or in your personal life, I can teach you how to eliminate fights and arguments forever. You will never have a fight or argument again in your life.
That is a thing I'm going to take you up on. I'll check it out on your website, and we'll be talking again soon, sir.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
All right, man. All right, rest of you guys, peace. We are out. Doug, I'll talk to you in a second.